call Senate Labor and Commerce to order. It is 1:30, March 28th, and with us today, Senator Seekins and Senator Davis, myself, Bundy, Senator Stevens is en route. And today we have a report on confirmation of appointments. We will take that up first. Then we'll go to SB 307, Landlord Remedies Late Fees, and SB 300, the Motor Vehicle Negative Equity Bill. Then we have two new bills to discuss, SB 309 and 241. Let's start with report on confirmation for appointments. Just for the record, we have the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. That would be Cody Downs of Anchorage, Charlotte Lushin of Fairbanks, and Alice Massey of Wasilla. The Real Estate Appraisers, it's William Larick from Anchorage. Alaska Workers' Compensation Board, Robert Moragu from Anchorage, Deborah Norum, Fairbanks, Jeffrey Press, Fairbanks, Barbie Scarborough, Anchorage, Damian Thomas, Fairbanks, Robert Wheel, Anchorage, Alaska Labor Relations Agency, Dennis Niedermeyer from King Salmon, Board of Marine Pilots, Les Krunk from Ketchikan, Personnel Board, Alfred Tanagi from Anchorage. We will move these names forward. However, this does not reflect intent by any member to vote for or against any of the people that I have mentioned in future sessions.
You want a motion to that effect, Mr.
Chairman? Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that the listed names that are included on the February 27th memorandum and have been accompanied by the resumes be forwarded to the Senate for confirmation with no intent noted by any of the members to either vote for or against the person in any future hearing.
Without objection, we'll move that forward. Okay, that takes us to Senate Bill 307, Landlord Remedies. And is there anyone here in the room that would like to speak on 307? Seeing none, Mr. Sniffen from Department of Law is online, and I have shared with the committee a letter I received from him addressing some concerns. And Mr. Sniffen, are you with us?
Yes, Chairman Bundy, thank you.
All right. Now, as I understand this bill, if we were to move to the 7-day notice that the bill calls for, it would allow people to be late in their rent, basically monthly. If, however, we went to the 10-day, if they were late more than twice in a year, they could be basically summarily evicted. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I understand that scenario exactly, but it is my understanding that under the current bill, if a tenant is late on their rent, the landlord can issue a 7-day notice to quit, and if the tenant cures the problem, then there's no usually no eviction. But if the tenant repeats that offense within so many months, and I don't recall the exact number of days, then the tenant can give a shorter period, excuse me, the landlord can give a shorter notice period to evict the tenant. And I believe Kari Christensen might be also online from Anchorage, who has more information about the details of how those multiple offense evictions might work.
Ms. Christensen, are you with us? No, apparently not yet. Well, I've been given to understand, my question was that the goal of the bill was to consolidate, as I understand it, the both the late fee collection time period and the notice for non-payment of rent to 7 days. Previously, they had 10 days to cure a late fee, but 7 days to basically pay the rent before eviction process would start. And the goal is to consolidate all within 7. And my question is, why not go to 10? And I've been led to believe that if we went to 10, someone violates the late fee proposal in the 10-day scheme of things, they only get to do that twice in a 6-month period before they are liable to the eviction process. Mr. Sniffen, going back to your letter, could you address for the committee again your general concerns about the bill?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Bundy, and I do want to stress these are simply concerns we want to bring the committee's attention, and the department doesn't take a position on whether these are good or bad things, but simply just factual things and the effect of this legislation, what it would have. And essentially what this would do is, as I explained in my March 14th letter, it would allow landlords to evict tenants for failing to pay late fees just as though they had failed to pay rent. And currently, they have to provide not only a different notice for failure to pay late fees and other charges. The standard of review applied by the court in determining whether to evict someone for failing to pay those fees is different. The court must decide whether or not the failure to pay those fees constitutes a material breach of the rental agreement. Whereas if you have a tenant who's failed to pay rent, rent is sort of separated out from all other fees and charges. And when a court is faced with a situation where a tenant has failed to pay rent and is deciding whether an eviction would be appropriate, the landlord simply needs to submit evidence that the rent wasn't paid and there were no defenses, and then eviction can follow. So there are different standards of review, so to speak, that a court engages in when reviewing a failure to pay rent versus a failure to pay a late fee. And what this legislation would do is it would combine those into a streamlined procedure, as the proponents have advocated, that would allow the landlords to issue one notice that would include not only the late rent, but whatever late fees could be associated with that rent, and then a court would decide if that combined fee wasn't paid, whether or not eviction would be appropriate. And the court would not need to engage in the analysis to determine whether that constituted a material breach of the rental agreement, because the late fees essentially would be rolled into the rental amount.
As you said, then, you view this as a streamlining of the process, and by definition, then, not payment of late fees is a breach of the contract.
Chairman Bundy, that's correct, yes.
Okay. Senator Seekins has a question.
Maybe not a question, just a comment. I have a real problem with that. I like streamlining the process, but I do have a problem in considering non-payment of late fees to be a material breach of the agreement, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I could understand if it was a repetitive thing over a period of time that I could look at it that way, but I have a problem with that being lumped in as a material breach, and I'd like to see if we could address that, quite frankly.
We have a couple other people to testify, so let's see if we can flesh this out a little more.
Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question.
Yes, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sniffen, is it just late fees on the rent, or are there other ancillary fees involved here that the landlords want to put all in one notice?
Yes, I apologize. Through the chair, the statute doesn't actually use the term late fee when it discusses the 10-day notice that is required to evict somebody for failure to pay that. It's under AS 3403-220A2, it just says any other fees, and essentially anything owed to the landlord that is not rent falls under this 10-day notice period, and before an eviction can occur for non-payment of any of those other charges, whatever they may be, the court needs to determine that that constitutes a material breach of the rental agreement.
So it could be, thank you, Mr. Chairman, it could be any other kind of charges, surcharges on the dumpster, the trash service, or anything that might be in dispute between the tenant and the landlord?
Through the chair, yeah, that is correct. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, let me, would you walk through this with me, help my understanding? So someone has a $1,000 a month rent payment. They are late. They are, under current law, they are allowed 7 days to cure that delinquency. Say now, because they are late, there's another $100 tacked on to the rent. So if they pay the $1,000 within 7 days, then they must pay the $100 within a 10-day period beginning when the rent was due. Otherwise, then they begin the they're liable to begin the eviction process. Is that accurate?
Chairman Bundy, I believe that is correct, yes.
And under the new bill, if they're late for their rent, they then would basically owe $1,100 in 7 days rather than $1,000 in 7 days and an additional $100 in three more days.
Yes, Chairman Bundy, that is correct, but there is a the distinction between those two scenarios is the $1,100 that is now owed would be reviewed by the court just as though it was late rent, as opposed to $1,000 late rent and $100 in other charges. So the effect of that would be if the tenant came up with $1,000 within the 7-day period under the current statute, the tenant could pay the landlord and the landlord couldn't evict the tenant. The tenant would still owe the $100 late fee, but the landlord would have to collect that separately from the rent, either through the 10-day notice to quit and allege that failure to pay the $100 was a material breach, or perhaps another action. If there are other fees the tenant owes, they could bring a small claims action or take legal action to collect the money. There's no question that the tenant still owes that money. The question is, do you want to evict the tenant for failing to pay those amounts as opposed to evicting the tenant for failure to pay rent?
Okay, thank you. Senator Seekins has a question.
And let me ask you this, Ed, if I can. This is Ralph Seekins. In your on page 2 in the third paragraph of your letter to us, there's one sentence there that says the court is not required to consider whether the late fee is reasonable. Is there, and I'm not familiar with the statutes having to do with rent, but is there anything in our statute that puts a cap on what a late fee can be?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, that's a good question, and I don't believe there's anything specifically in statute that puts a cap on a late fee. I think there are some common law principles and perhaps even some consumer protection principles that we could apply to some completely outrageous and unreasonable late fees, and I think a tenant could argue that a late fee that is excessive is not enforceable. And I think there is some case law out there that discusses that issue, and I won't go into the details of that, but essentially the late fee needs to be reasonably related to your costs of having to pursue late rent.
But here in this case, what you're saying is that would be a different type of an action. The court is not required to consider whether or not that late fee is reasonable. They can evict whether they determine it's a reasonable late fee or not.
Through the chair and Senator Seekins, that is correct. If the statute is amended to reflect the current proposed amendment, the court would not need to consider the reasonableness of the late fee. The late fee now becomes essentially part of the rent, and it's either you paid it or you didn't. I will have to say that I think others who might testify later can support this, that the current practice among the judiciary is a little uneven. There, some courts, when you get before them, and they will allow tenants to argue about, I think, pretty much anything you want to argue about, and those judges will consider those arguments and determine whether or not you need to pay a late fee, even if it was lumped together with rental charges, because I think that's how the practice has worked in the past. But the law wouldn't require that, and that is something for, I think, this committee to consider. Even though a court may decide to do that at some time, the statute as proposed would not require the court to do that. The court could simply evict somebody if they didn't pay a late fee along with the rental. And there are some defenses to not paying the rent. Maybe you had to pay utilities that month because the landlord didn't. Maybe you had to effectuate some repairs and you're entitled to an offset. Those are some traditional defenses to not paying rent, but you wouldn't really get to argue that for the late fee unless the court really just on its own allowed you to.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have Mr. Bob Maurer online, and he can help us with some of these questions as well. Are you with us, Mr. Mayor?
Thank you very much. If I could, if anyone has any questions first, or if not, I'll just make a couple
of statements. Well, yeah, help me with understanding the scenario. Was I correct in saying I'm a tenant and I owe a rent of $1,000 and it's due on the first of the month? I do not pay it by the first of the month. It accrues a late fee beginning from the first of the month, and I have 7 days in which to pay my rent, and then I have 3 more days in which to pay the late fee? Or did my late fee be 10 days begin after the 7 day period?
Well, generally rent falls due on the first of the month. There's usually, say, a 10 day grace period. After the end of that 10 day period, that would be, say, on the 11th day, the late fee would be assessed. As I understand your question, as it stands now, the landlord has to hang a 7 day notice for the rent and a separate 10 day notice for the late fee. Now, this requires two separate court actions, two separate lawsuits, or two separate evictions, in essence. The question has come up about putting both on a 10 day notice. Okay. You're playing with the mic. On a 10 day notice. You were correct initially in stating that the rules are different for a 7 day notice than for a 10 day notice. On a 10 day notice, there is a 6 month reoccursion provision which kicks in. In other words, if the tenant did not pay a late fee two times, or say three times, the tenant could be evicted if a 10 day notice was used for both rent and late fee. On a 7 day notice, this reoccurrence provision does not fall into play. The tenant can reoffend each and every month, and as long as the tenant cures within the 7 days, the tenant's fine. The questions also come up, and correct, yes, including the late fee now, the judge could evict on for both rent and late fee. I think, as we all know, with our mortgage payments, with our utility payments, that things are due on time, and if they're not, there's a penalty. And Star Natural Gas has got one, Chugach Electric's got one, and all this does is, all SB 307 does, is allow the communication process to improve between the landlord and the tenant. If a $500 rent is owed and not received by the 10th, On the 7 day notice to quit, it will say $500 plus $50, total now doing $550. Now, if the tenant came up after that period and said, "Hey, I got the $500, but I don't have the $50 late fee," no landlord is going to go through the whole process of having to turn their apartment, go to court. $435 now for an FED that the court awards. It costs the landlord. Take the time to get the tenant out, go in, have to redo the apartment, clean it up, and then re-rent it. Now, that's where the rubber meets the road. A landlord will not go through the process just to collect the late fee. He'll wait for it. The questions come up now. The judge can legally evict for the late fee if you go to a 7 day notice that it would be included as rent. Well, the same thing happens. I think, as Ed Sniffen referred to, the district court is sort of the wild, wild west of the judicial system. The judges have a wide array of decisions that they can make, and they don't necessarily always stick to the letter of the law. And I've been 200-300 of these FEDs, and I've never seen a judge ever evict for a late fee. That's pretty much what I have to say here.
Oh, okay. Help me understand a little bit more, too. When you talk about hanging the notice and it's two separate court actions, do you actually have to go to court and get a legal document, or is this something that you can
have? Well, what you have to do is landlords can represent, you can represent yourself personally in court, but generally you have an attorney do it. So say rent is due on the 1st. If it's not received, a $500 rent is not received by the 10th, the 10-day grace period. On the 11th, you can hang your notice to quit. It's a 7-day notice to quit. So that would give the tenant till basically, say, the 18th to pay the rent. If rent is not received by then and there's been no communication or whatever the case is, you would send that notice into your attorney. There it'll sit for a few days. Then he'll take it to the court. The court will set a court date 10 to 14 days out. And then you have the process server and the whole nine yards, and you hope to get your eviction.
Yeah, the original hanging, now that's just a form that the landlord would have, and he doesn't have to go to court to get that form.
Well, the clerk of the court does provide, the clerk of a court does have a standard form that they wish everybody did use.
Yeah, and so what current law requires is, assuming someone is continuing to be in arrearage, the landlord makes one trip to the apartment to hang the 7-day notice, and then when do you hang the 10-day notice?
You would hang that right now under current law. You would have to hang that. You would hang the 10-day notice at the same time. So okay. You're dealing with two separate pieces of paper, with two different amounts of money, and two different dates due. Historically, we never had to do this in the state of Alaska until the courts did rule correctly during the Nakamoto decision that we've always been doing it wrong, and the court did rule correctly. And all we're trying to asking here is that the situation be restored to historically it always has been.
And what was the date of that ruling?
2002.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to make some more general comments?
That pretty much sums it up. Again, we're not trying, these things tend to get wrapped around the axle here sometimes. And, we're just trying to keep it simple. We're trying to simplify things. And that's pretty much all I have to say right now.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't see any additional questions right now. We have another person online from Alaska Legal Services that would like to testify. And I'm fearful of attempting your last name.
It's Gorian Dedukian, sir.
Pronounce it again for me, please.
The last name is Dedukian.
Dedukian. Okay, thank you. Well, that would have been approximately what I'd have tried, but that's
well, thank
no
you, Mr.
courage.
My name is Gorian Dedukian. I'm a staff attorney with Alaska Legal Services. I'm one of the attorneys that worked on the Nakamoto decision that Mr. Mayor referred to, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about the committee has about that case. I want to say a couple of things today. First, I want to let the committee know how I interpret the bill, and I have not seen the amended version, but I agree with Mr. Stiffen that what the bill does, what SB 307 does, is to make a non-payment of late fees a material breach by definition. So what that means is that no matter how big or small the late fee is, if a tenant has paid all the rent that's due but has not paid the late fee, the landlord can take them to court and have them evicted and have them move out of their homes within 48 hours. I disagree with Mr. Mayor that the current state of the law requires two separate court actions. That's simply not the case. A landlord, as he said, could give a 7-day notice, and it has the option of giving a 10-day notice if a tenant has not paid late fees. But there's nothing that would keep the landlord from combining those two notices into a single action and proceeding based under both of them in an eviction case. And Mr. Mayor also said that there's no landlord in his right mind or her right mind that if a tenant has paid all their rent and has not paid the late fees, that they would actually go to the trouble of taking them to court for an eviction. But if that were the case, then there'd be no need for this law. And what this law does is give landlords the right to do just that, which is to take a tenant to court and have them evicted if they haven't paid their late fees. And as Mr. Sniffen said, it makes nonpayment of late fees a material breach by definition. I also want to talk briefly about this whole idea that SB 307 might streamline the process for landlords. I think that there might be some unintended consequences here for both landlords and the court system that may not have been thought about. Right now, it's very easy for a landlord to comply with the law. All the landlord has to do is segregate the rent that is late and put it in a seven-day notice. And if they end up in court and the judge determines that the late rent has not been paid, the judge's hands are tied and the person has to be evicted. If the notice starts to include late fees, then tenant advocates like myself and other tenant advocates at Alaska Legal Services and with other law firms, the only defense they're going to have is to challenge the reasonableness of that late fee. And here I do disagree with Mr. Sniffen, and I think there's nothing that would prevent a tenant from raising the reasonableness of the late fee at an eviction hearing. I think anything else would deprive these tenants of due process, because if a landlord is trying to charge an unreasonable late fee, the tenant should have the right to argue whether or not that late fee is reasonable at the FED hearing. And what this would do is convert a 5- or 10-minute hearing into a 30-minute hearing, where the court would have to take testimony on what the landlord's expenses are every time the tenant is late, and other testimony so the court can determine whether or not that late fee is reasonable. The last thing I want to say is that it's no secret that this bill is trying to overturn the Nakamoto decision, and I firmly stand behind the principle of that decision. I think it's a just decision, and the principle behind it is that eviction is a very harsh remedy. It makes people homeless. Families with children have to move, and the children have to change schools and so forth. And what Judge Ridner said in Nakamoto is, because eviction is so harsh, we should limit it to only the most major breaches. And some examples of the most major breaches are if the tenant hasn't paid rent, or if the tenant is disturbing the other tenants of the building, or if the tenant is engaging in drug use or prostitution in the building. But it shouldn't be used for such things as late fees or parking fees or fines or other secondary things that the landlord still has the right to collect all that through an FED action and even serve a 10-day notice, but it shouldn't be by itself grounds to evict the tenant based on a 7-day notice. As it is, there are studies done that show that tenants lose in court about 90% of the time, even if they have a lawyer. And the whole reason behind the Landlord-Tenant Act, the Uniform Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, was to make more of a level playing field between landlords and tenants. And given the statistics and the figures that I just quoted, this legislature doesn't have to be making it any easier for landlords to evict their tenants. So that is the gist of my testimony today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And just on a practical level of the timing, if this bill passes, all that the potential evicted tenant loses is 3 days. Isn't that correct? You've got a 7-day notice and a 10-day notice.
Well, that's part of it, sir, but I think there's more to that, as Mr. Sniffen was trying to explain. The 7-day notice is automatic, and the 10-day notice, you still have to prove that the breach was a material breach, that it's an important breach, and it's one that should lead to eviction. So as of now, if a landlord asks for the late fees in a 10-day notice, the tenant can argue whether or not it's material. And that's different than what I was just talking about, which is, if the late fees are included in the 7-day notice, the only thing the tenant would be able to argue is that they're unreasonable. But that's a much higher burden to meet than showing that the late fees are not, whether or not they're material. So I think there's slightly more than the 3 days at stake.
All right, thank you. Other questions? I don't see any at this point. The legal question as far as the court suit is one that I guess would defer to Judiciary Committee. The decision that I would ask the committee to focus on here is this in best interest of landlords and tenants, and balancing that view. Having been a landlord at one time, I have some have to declare some, perhaps I'm no longer one, but some residual conflict here, and did evict a person, and it took months. However, I'd have, I have some sympathy too toward throwing people out in the cold. Though it appears to me as well, if that's happening, what we have is not, my example, $1,000 a month rent. We have, if we're chronically late, our rent is then $1,100 or $1,300, whatever the late fee is, and perhaps those people have some more serious challenges than just the late fee. Discussion of the, is there anyone else here who would like to testify on the bill? I will close public testimony and turn to committee for discussion. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I realize I get another shot at the bill in the following committee. But it seems to me, and I do have some rental properties, not for residential but for commercial, low-income folks are really the most likely to be late on a rental payment, higher probability. And a landlord who has no limit on reasonableness of a late fee can count on exponentially increasing his rental income by charging an exorbitant late fee with the threat of eviction if the late fees are considered to be a material breach. And, if it doesn't happen now, there doesn't seem to be a good reason for authorizing a new process that would include those as a material breach. I mean, fair practice can only be assured by fair policy. I would like to hold on to the bill for a little bit and just take a look at that, if you don't mind, and I'd like to examine some of the ramifications that are in Mr. Sneddon's letter, before. And I realize I get a second chance at it, but I think before we advance it out of committee that I'd like to get a couple of answers to consider.
How much time do you think you might need?
I'm done with PPT, I hear, on Wednesday, so I'll have a lot more time.
My question is, we meet on Thursday, and should I?
I don't mind putting it back on for Thursday. I can answer my own questions by then, sir.
Okay. We will hold the bill until Thursday for further discussion then. Thanks those who have testified. Excuse me. Now we go to a Senate Bill 300. Senator Seekins' bill, and we have a CS. Senator Seekins, would you like to move the adoption of the CS and speak to it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd move CS to this bill. It's titled / G, golf, for G in the upper right-hand corner.
I will object for explanation.
Mr. Chairman, as we looked at the bill and as several of the ancillary experts that also look at every automotive bill that comes along, the National Automobile Dealer Association and the American Association of Automobile Manufacturers, we noticed, or they picked up, that, and something that I had suspected but I hadn't come to the same conclusion, that we needed to change one more section of the statute in order to make this comply. And I mentioned that to you the last time we heard the bill. And that was to modify AS 4510030A. And you can see on page 2 the underlined material there under subparagraph 11. If the retail installment contract is for the sale of a motor vehicle, the amount, if any, that the seller agrees to pay to discharge an outstanding obligation to the buyer under an existing motor vehicle agreement, loan, installment sales contract, or lease, and then a couple of other renumbering things. And again, a little farther down under AS 4510225, it's the same basic statement. So this now brings us into a position of compliance where all of our statutes that deal with retail installment contracts reflect the same material. And our legal people now believe this does that, as do the legal people from the National Automobile Dealer Association and the Automobile Manufacturers Association. And I do agree. So I would appreciate your support.
Remove my objection to any other objection to adopting this. Yes, seeing none. We do have Mr. Sniffen online again. Mr. Sniffen?
Yes, Chairman Bundy.
You have seen the CS?
Yes, I have, and I agree with Senator Seekins that that change just is really one of conformity to make the statute consistent, and the department has no objection to that.
So anyone else would like to testify on Senate Bill 300? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. I don't see any amendments. Senator Seekins?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 300 from committee with with this CS, and there is no fiscal note.
And I would only say that I certainly hope that there aren't many people who need to deal in negative equities, that they can hang on to their car just a little longer, even though that might have an impact on business.
Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you that I encourage that myself. I would be very disappointed if someone in my own family that took advice from Grandpa or Dad would do that, but it is a reality we need to deal with.
I understand that. Jane?
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. That brings us to Senate Bill 309, simple little bill that hasn't been controversial at all. Okay, Senator Terrio, we'll stand at ease for a moment. Senator Terrio is en route. Okay, we're back on the record, and no, we're not. Where's Senator Terrio? You came in. I was ready to go. Would you like to present Senator Terrio's bill?
I can present it.
Yeah.
Perfect, folks. All
and you could muck it up so bad that I mean,
309.
We'll stand at ease again. And with us is Senator Theriault. There are no further questions. Would someone like to move the bill? Senator Theriault, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the members of the committee for hearing Senate Bill 309. There is a proposed committee substitute that corrects some technical issues at the request of the Department of Labor, and I'd like to just touch base on those, and then I'll leave it up to you.
Senator Theriault, we will go ahead and adopt the committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekins.
I'd move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill 309, identified in the upper right-hand corner as /I or India, as our working document.
Without objection, that's our working document. Senator Theriault.
Thank you. Just to go over the slight changes. In Section 1, page 2, line 1, the sentence, the amount collected in this subsection is in addition to the amount collected under AS 2315-835 was deemed to be unnecessary, so that language was dropped. Also on page 2, paragraph D, the words interest and penalties were deleted, and a reference to paragraph A was added. So those were the two changes. This legislation responds to an upcoming opportunity to train residents to fill thousands of high-paying jobs that will be created in the construction of a gas pipeline, or certainly an opportunity that we hope that will be coming our way soon, and other growing construction needs by providing a stable stream of revenue subject to legislative appropriation to the Alaska Works Partnership, Inc., for both training and increasing capacity of training facilities. With a project as large as a gas pipeline and the thousands of jobs it will create, we must now make sure residents of Alaska are trained and employable. Senate Bill 309 provides the multi-year commitment necessary to achieve this goal. In 2005, there were more than 20,000 individuals employed in the Alaska construction trades with annual incomes approaching $60,000 each. Unfortunately, one in every five jobs, or 20% of those 60,000 or 20,000 jobs, belongs to individuals who, according to the permanent fund dividend eligibility information, were recent arrivals to the state of Alaska or temporary residents of the state. Also, with our 45% of our resident construction workforce being over 45 years of age, the industry must start to renew its workforce with thousands of appropriately trained workers. Without action on our part, these high-paying jobs will continue to attract workers from other states and other countries. The Alaska Works Partnership is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to increase resident hire in the construction trades. The funding proposed in this bill will leverage industry investment in training facilities and equipment to build private sector training capacity and increase industry capability for sustaining training into the future. More than 90% of the workers Alaska Work Partnership trains are not members of a union. The majority of the workers the Alaska Works Partnership places in jobs go to work for non-union employers. With increased pay, or the legislation is intended to divert 0.1% of the current employee contributions to a new holding account for appropriation each year by the legislature. The estimated income of the account is projected to be roughly $5 million per year. With the increased payroll within the state, the Department of Labor has projected that it is highly unlikely that this small percentage diversion will cause an increase in the overall unemployment rates that are insurance rates. As we grow the base, the 1% should not trigger any change in the rates that are charged. This legislation is slated to sunset in 6 years and requires annual reporting on performance standards. As we work through the committee process, I ask members to consider placing a priority on training of residents Alaskans to get the benefit from increasing heavy construction, highway construction, general construction, and certainly construction that would take place on the oil line. In addition, I believe we want to certainly be taking a longer look, not at just the construction jobs associated with taking that resource to market, but also the legacy jobs that would be left over in operating and maintaining facilities. I recognize there are other ideas on how best to apply this funding to get Alaskans training, the training that they need, through the committee process. Once again, I hope we can do our best to accommodate these other points of view. Also here to testify today, we have Commissioner O'Cleary with the Department of Labor. He can further outline the Alaska projected training needs and how this legislation can help to address them. He has, I believe his assistant Guy Bell is here to answer technical questions about the fiscal notes or funding mechanism in the legislature. We also have, I believe, Mike Andrews with the Alaska Works Partnership to brief members on how this his organization can play a part in, in this training. Also, I want to let members know that I did meet with Rebecca Logan with the Associated Builders and Contractors. She's here today to share her organization's view of 309 and the training. And in my conversation with Ms. Logan this morning, she pointed out that from their perspective, one of the problems with actually getting employees trained is that when you get to the apprenticeship portion of a lot of the job training, you actually have to have an employer who's willing to take on that new trainee, pair them with a journeyman, but yet you've got the issue of the salary has to be paid for. And so I think you're going to hear a suggestion that if there is some way that you could assist employers in actually bringing in the trainee and helping to get them up to speed, that may in fact be a component of the overall training mechanism that is missing right now. And especially if we're planning on ramping up, not just to meet the construction or the employer needs that we are hearing about today, but as we think we're going to need to ramp up for the jobs that we hope to have here in the state in the near future. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm willing to answer questions. I hope I've given you the indication that I am certainly willing to try and incorporate different thoughts, keeping my eye on the ball of training Alaskans to take advantage of the jobs, both the near-term and long-term, that we hope to generate here in the state.
Thank you. Commissioner, we have an extra seat here. Would you join us and have a seat there? We'll get to your testimony in a moment.
Well, the presiding officer doesn't show up.
Yeah, well, in that case, we'll both leave the room. Thank you, Senator Terrio. I have a couple of questions. One of the concerns that I've heard from as this bill was beginning its way through the process is that it was aimed at union jobs, that everybody would be paying and these workers would all be filtered into union jobs. Could you address that concern?
Well, as I indicated, the information that I was provided with indicates that the Alaska Works Partnership, the people that are trained there, there's no requirement that they be in a union, and a lot of the placements that they've done out of that training has been in non-union shops. Now, I still am sort of learning the way that the current system all works with, again, the apprenticeship program and, what obligations there are there. I think that ultimately if we try and keep our eye on, again, just the training of the workers that we need, whether they end up in a union shop or non-union shop, what we have to do in the bill to accommodate that, I certainly am willing to consider. So if there are different suggestions that are made today that strike you and other committee members as common sense, I'm certainly willing to consider whatever it takes to train Alaskans.
But at this point, you don't view this as public money being used only to benefit potential union members?
No, that's not my intent. I think that you'll hear from some of the other members that are individuals that are here to testify on whether, in fact, that's the way they see things. But again, I'm open to understanding the criticisms and what we need to do.
Well, that's why we're here. We'll flesh this out. And both potential employers as well as potential employees would benefit. However, this seems to be a tax on the employee. Why wasn't it broadened? Did you not view that necessarily?
Mr. Chairman, it's patterned after a revenue-generating mechanism that's already in state statute that funds TVEP and the STEP programs. Some of that funding then is then earmarked to university and community colleges. So I didn't go out set out to reinvent the wheel. I just copied what was already in state law.
And there are those, I suppose, who would have, say, service industry jobs that aren't likely to move over into the construction jobs, yet they would likely make their contribution as well. Is that correct?
It would be generated system-wide, so that, I guess, is a legit criticism. I guess, though, it would be a legit criticism of the current system that we have in place, too.
All right. Questions for Senator Terrio? I didn't know there were any people in North Pole that supported taxes, but it's nice to know there are some. Next thing, we'll have head taxes.
It's not an increase in tax. It's just a diversion.
A diversion. Okay. All right. I accept that. A diversionary tactic of taxes. thank you, Senator Terrio. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I always feel nervous sitting at the table with you all.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good
afternoon.
Good day. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Greg O'Clary, the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. One of the greatest challenges I've had since being appointed and serving as commissioner has been to meet the governor's goal of 90% Alaska hire on across the board on all industries in Alaska. As you know, the only statutory authority we have to require the 90% rule is in public construction, and we've come close, but we're just below the surface of meeting that requirement on a consistent basis. We will always have to import some numbers of construction workers if we don't adopt the approach that Senator Terrio has introduced. It gives me great pleasure, and I'm very excited about this particular bill, because the existing STEP program, the State Training and Employment Program, cannot shoulder the entire burden of training our construction workforce to meet the industry demands over the next 6 years and still be poised to capture a majority of the pipeline jobs that will come our way should we start turning dirt on that project. For the members, you have in front of you three pieces of paper that were information provided on projected numbers of construction workers for the gas pipeline, pre-construction, construction, and overall project numbers. And I'll just focus on the overall project numbers and go craft by craft, because I think it's important for us to recognize the enormous numbers of people that we require to build this project. Pipe fitters and welders, 400 to 500. Equipment operators, 1,900 to 2,300. Truck drivers, 2,000 to 2,500. Laborers, including welders helpers, 1,200 to 1,600. Supervisory positions alone will be 400 to 500. And others that include the construction inspectors, camp employees, and catering personnel, electricians, and iron workers will be another 900 to 1,000, which will give us a range of total construction workers between 6,900 and 8,600 workers. Now, that is with respect to the pipeline project. The industry, the construction industry, and the Alaska Workforce Investment Board and the State Department of Labor spent 2 years examining and developing a construction plan to deal with the workforce needs of Alaska's construction industry, and a copy of that report has been provided to members. And Senator Terrio spoke to the numbers that were needed in terms of our overall challenge just to keep pace with that industry, and this particular bill will meet that demand. As you know, I've come before this committee before, and I'll probably be seeing some of you again as the capital budget is heard. This year we will initiate a pilot project in Anchorage with the Anchorage School District to train some 100 to 200 construction workers that will enter the residential construction field primarily as home builders. And there's a lot of support for that particular approach. It will require a initial about $1 million to begin that budget. This particular funding stream is my intent to instead of coming back to the legislature on an annual basis asking for general fund monies, this funding stream will meet some of those needs. In addition to that, it will meet the needs of upgrading our capacity for training workers. Now, the reason why we support this bill and the use of Alaska Works Partnership as the main vehicle for training workers is because they're the best at it. They have the highest performance of every grantee on a consistent basis that we have. Their graduates from their training programs are placed between 88 and 90% almost in every field of endeavor that we grant to them. Frankly, it's I know that there's some concern about using one entity, and we talked to the bill sponsor about this before, but I can tell you they are the best. And in terms of getting the most bang for our buck, this is why we're recommending that we go this way. The other thing that you should be aware of, there are only two states in the United States that actually tax workers for a portion of the dollars that go into providing unemployment insurance benefits, our state and the state of New Jersey. And this is the proper use of some of this money that's contributed by workers because it reduces unemployment. It also increases their earning power to move them up the ladder. So as commissioner, I can tell you that I'm proud to support this bill, and I would hope the committee would move expeditiously to approve it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just a couple of questions. Just your thoughts on recruiting people to take advantage of this training. You know, I've had these conversations before, and, you know, I'm very supportive of recognize the dignity of making a living by working with your hands. But we've also known that instances where Dick Catnaw has tried to recruit young people to sweat and work and make a decent living, and many of them show a great disinterest to that occurring. We have the demand from the employer side. Are you aware, is there a demand from the potential employee side, when we make these services available, are young people going to take advantage of them?
Mr. Chairman, we had this conversation during my confirmation hearings 3 years ago, and since then I've had a lot of conversation with young people, a lot of conversations with educators, and a lot of conversation with parents. And this year we initiated through some federal money what we call the through a high growth training grant, the career guides into our K-12 system, to actually go into the school systems and help guide young people into making career choices, and of course, because there are existing advocates for post-secondary education, we're advocating for folks that want to make their living with their hands, and we're having tremendous success, and the school districts have been very cooperative with. Moving our folks into that school system. As you know, we're on 36 radio stations twice a day, 5 days a week, advocating for vocational education. But the primary theme we are using now is asking young people to be ready to work when they leave school, to be ready, because work ethic, you're not born with it. I mean, it has to be either instilled by the parent or by the educational system, or by actual work experience. And I believe that the recruiting will not be a problem here.
Thank you. And one other question, if I might. Like a lot of us, I was here during the TAPS pipeline days, and remember that Alaskans couldn't get jobs as pipeline welders because it's a very closed shop, and if you aren't the grandson of a welder, you just don't get there. Do you anticipate that same kind of situation in the gas line welding project?
Mr. Chairman, I am familiar with the language that is currently shielded in the gas pipeline negotiating contract, and I believe the language is better than was in the TAPS, and it will certainly, I think, we're poised to make certain that Alaskans get the first shot at every one of those jobs if they're qualified.
Well, I'm not looking forward to seeing on the front page of the paper pay stubs for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week again. Questions? Senator Seekins had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you know, this is a big bunch of people. Where do you think they're going to come from?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Seekins, primarily out of our K-12 system, Senator, out of high school, and those that are dropping out of high school today. That is the largest concentration of new workers, not only and across the state, not just the population centers, but also from rural Alaska.
Don't you anticipate that there will be some recruitment into that process from people who are already in the workforce?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, folks, I think will change careers. The last study I saw nationally is that young people nowadays change careers over 10 times during their lifetime. So I believe there will be some folks wanting to move into the construction field.
I also lived through the previous pipeline construction era, and I wasn't an employer at that particular time, but I worked for someone who was, and there was a terrible strain on that employer because the recruiting process for those jobs went right down into the workforce and put a lot of strain on people to find employers to fill those empty jobs. Are we trying to consider anything in terms of assisting that vacuum?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Seekins, my overall strategy as commissioner has been to do both. That is why that I feel that with creating this new funding stream that focuses on construction, it frees up additional investments that I'm now using in the STEP program to do exactly as you suggest, is that make sure we train replacement workers so that we don't have a serious vacuum of other types of classifications across the board when we start building a pipeline. This will be a gradual buildup over the next 6 years, and I think we will be able then to kind of stem the flow of the vacuum that was created during TAPS.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm glad to hear about that cross-training so the English major can stop saying, you want fries with your Big Mac, Beth?
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekins. Senator Terrio, one of those senators over there.
Commissioner, and I appreciate you letting me ask questions. Can you just give us a little bit of information on this, you know, thought that the employers, there is part of the bottleneck in the system right now is employers who are willing to take on somebody who is a trainee, either in an apprenticeship program or in some other, you know, capacity, and actually, you know, take somebody sort of under the wing to train them up, match them up with an experienced worker. I'm remembering back, you know, 25 or 30 years ago, the gentleman that worked at our welding shop, his wife was employed in retail. And I remember I don't know if it was just for a quarter or, you know, two quarters, the state had a program that would help with the salary for the trainee while, in fact, they were getting up and becoming a real a productive employee. Do we still have a system in this overall state system that helps like that, or how do you help, you know, the small employer maybe that can't necessarily afford to pick up the salary for a trainee, especially if the trainee then can take a job wherever they want when they're done with their training?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Terrio, there are some existing programs still around, but primarily what happens here is that there needs to be a need for these apprentices, and employers and contractors need to make room for them. The construction trades most of them have moved toward doubling the number of apprentices that they interview and take in to their various programs to meet the ongoing demand. I can get back to you specifically about the programs that are there for wage subsidies is what you're talking about. But they're across the board. Very seldom do we ever use wage subsidies in the construction industry because these folks are working on the job. They're, you know, not many of these young people that get recruited as apprentices are late starters. They're all pretty skookum folks. And for the most part, they complete their apprenticeship and turn out as journeymen because there's a lot of demands on these workers. And we don't have the problem with work ethic with apprentices, I can almost guarantee you, because they don't make it through the interview process.
Thank you. Senator Seekins has a question. Then, if I can ask the committee's indulgence, we have quite a number of people like to testify, and I'd certainly like to get in their testimony.
Just one quick question, and maybe it could be followed up on, but I was just curious. One of the things that we're looking at hiring practices in a lot of different places and across the state. I was surprised to find out that the average age of a new hire into the school system for a teacher in Fairbanks area was about 35 years old. I'm wondering if in the current apprenticeship program there's a demographic there as to what age group that it's attracting at this particular time. Just curious. Maybe I could get that later.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Seekins, I can provide you with some of that information, but I did want to make one last point, and that is with the Alaska Works and these through the STEP program, our relationships with these private labor management training entities is that they provide a tremendous amount of match, not only in kind, but in actual hard dollars to our grants. And I'll just give you an example. The Alaska Joint Electrical Apprenticeship and Training Trust received a STEP grant in 05 of $191,000. Their match was $490,300. I mean, that's the kind of things that we're doing now. There are other examples. The Laborers Training Trust received a grant of $292,000. Their grant, or their match, was $538,000. So it was more than a 2-to-1 match. So these are true government, private sector arrangements of cooperation. And I see creating this new funding stream, by the way, which will be targeted for the construction industry with the ultimate goal of filling most of the jobs on the gas pipeline project. So it's, as I said, I'm excited about this particular approach. I think it's a sensible way to go, and it certainly will make more Alaskan paychecks stay home.
Thank you, Commissioner. As I said, we have a substantial number of people like to
testify. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We can excuse you, Commissioner. I'm sure there are other things that may need your attention. Michael Sexton, please. We can get some of you people testified, and you can go away, and then we have some room for everyone else to sit down. Welcome. Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Michael Sexton, and I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I am the executive director of the Mechanical Contractors of Fairbanks and the Mechanical Contractors of Alaska. And I'm here to lend my support to this bill. And I'm going to read some notes that I have here, and it says, construction in Alaska seems to be our legacy. And there's going to be a lot of construction in our future. And training is the key to being successful in any industry, and is no different for the construction industry. Good-paying jobs and training go hand in hand, and good pay is essential for keeping our young people at home in Alaska. We should be proactive now instead of reactive, and start our training now. And when the pipe, we referred to the TAPS pipeline, and it was kind of a mess then. So the more people we have in the state trained and ready for the skilled jobs that will be required, the fewer people we'll have to rely from out of the state. And somebody's going to do this high-tech work, and we might as well do it. And thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. Jim Leahy. And just for public information, a bill of this magnitude, we won't plan to move it today, but I do want to get in as much public testimony as possible. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Leahy. I'm from Fairbanks. I'm a business manager of the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters, Local 375, and I also sit on the Workforce Investment Board. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 309. I was fortunate in that I completed my five-year apprenticeship just prior to construction of TAPS. I've been able to work on jobs all over the state, and I can speak from firsthand experience on the value of apprenticeship training here in Alaska. While today I'm speaking for the Pipefitters, our program is representative of many of the craft programs. Trusts such as ours are jointly managed and have traditionally self-funded their training. These trusts provide oversight with an equal number of labor and employer trustees. It's clear that training by itself won't create a skilled workforce. In addition to classroom and hands-on and shop and field training, apprenticeship provides the direct linkage to on-the-job experience. In light of projected demands for our construction workforce, and with the goal of maximizing Alaskans on upcoming construction projects, I encourage you to support the programs that work and are already in place, and ask for you to support SB 309.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here. Max?
Chair Bundy, committee members.
Hello.
How you doing? My name is Max Melke. I'm the business manager of the Plumbers and Pipefitters Local Union 262, located here in Juneau. I represent approximately 120 members. We are strongly in favor of Senate Bill 309. Building and construction trade unions have been training journeymen and apprentices in Alaska for nearly 50 years. These training programs are administered jointly by contractors and union employees referred to as Joint Apprenticeship Training Committees, or JATCs. All the building and construction trade union JATCs in Alaska are accredited, registered apprenticeship programs with the federal government. It is a fact that union construction training programs are unsurpassed and some are considered the best in the world. Along with our contractors, we are on the leading edge of new technology and innovative ways to get the job done right and on time. In 1937, Plumbers and Pipefitters Local Union 262 was established here in Juneau. Up until 2003, we saved every penny with the anticipation of someday having our own training center. We have always sent our apprentices north either to Anchorage or Fairbanks for training. In 2003, we were able to purchase a 6,000 square foot office and training facility. We now have a fully furnished state-of-the-art training center. There is much more to be done if there was more funding. Our members are located throughout all Southeast Alaska. Each member pays right off his paycheck $1.40 per hour for training. July 1st, 2006, this amount goes to $1.65. Our contractors and members know how vital training is now and in the future of our industry. Local 262's Training Center is the only building and construction trades union school serving all Southeast Alaska. We could have the hub in Southeast Alaska for specialized training in pipeline helpers, apprentices, pipe fitters, and welders to work out of Fairbanks Pipe Trades Local 375 or Anchorage Local 367 for large-scale projects in their areas. The economic outlook for this state is bright. Training as many Alaskans as we can is essential in many areas, but especially in the building and construction trades industry. At this time, I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I don't see any, but thank you.
Thank you.
Bert? Bert Helms?
Brett.
Oh, Brett. I'm sorry. I misread. You can speak for Bert and Brett.
Okay. My name is Brett Helms. I'm training director for Local 375 out of Fairbanks. As training director for Local 375, Plumbers and Pipefitters Apprenticeship Program, I strongly support the training that is provided by jointly managed trade apprenticeships. These apprenticeships provide the majority of training in the construction trade industry. I know firsthand the significant investment that is made to maintain the quality of training they provide. Our training program is funded through hourly employer contributions to a jointly managed trust fund. These contributions have allowed this program to train apprentices and journeymen since 1951, supplying skilled craft workers to over 30 employers signatory to Local 375. Typically, an apprentice in our program completes 1,800 hours of classroom instruction and 8,000 hours of on-the-job training. Our operational expenses for 2005 exceeded $750,000 and are expected to increase again this year. We expect to enroll an additional 150 apprentices in our program over the next 6 years to supply the increased demand from our contractors. The Department of Labor projects a 17% increase by 2012 in the plumbing and pipe fitting field, This increase will only supply the current industry and does not reflect a future gas line. Our current training facility has two classrooms and a small shop area. This has served us well, but will not be adequate for the future training demands we are faced with. Along with expanding our facility, purchasing new equipment, we will also need to hire and train full and part-time instructors. All this requires a significant financial commitment from our employers, which might not be obtainable within the next few years. This is why I support Senate Bill 309 to provide the funding needed to train our future Alaskan workforce. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And those of you that have written copies of your testimony, if you'd like to leave them with us, we'll give it to the Secretary and save her some carpal tunnel syndrome. Mike Andrews? Afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. I should have zigged when I zagged on the ski slope here. But
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Andrews. I'm the director of Alaska Works Partnership, Inc., and I'm here to speak certainly in favor of Senate Bill 309. I want to thank Senator Theriault for providing a thoughtful solution to a serious problem, and that is the shortage of skilled workers for construction in the state of Alaska. I know you've been reading and hearing about the shortage. Just a quick rundown. The state projects there's about 20,000 construction workers. They made about 59,000 on average last year. The state predicts a shortage of at least 1,000 workers to fill new jobs. We've talked about the non-resident workforce, which equals about 4,000 workers. And if you want to drive that up to 90%, that's another 2,000 workers that we need to fill. If we're going to retiring workers, that's another 7,000 to 8,000 workers, just to have a stable resident construction workforce before we ever get to a pipeline. I've heard some interesting things. I'd like to try to answer some of the questions that I heard from senators here today, but I'd like to talk a little bit about Alaska Works. For decades, Alaskans have tried to find solutions for local hire on construction jobs, particularly in rural communities where there are fewer jobs and local construction jobs are a source of much-needed income. A person must have the right skills and work experience to be hired. If a person has neither skills nor work experience, they need training and job placement services, and that's what we do. In 1996, as construction began to rebound from the bust of the 1980s, the construction unions recognized they should play a broader role in developing Alaska's construction workforce. They decided to work together through a new organization that would offer uniquely Alaskan programs designed to help residents across the state get construction skills training, jobs, and opportunities to learn a trade through apprenticeship training. Alaska's construction trade unions formed Alaska Works Partnership, Inc., a not-for-profit beginning in Fairbanks, Alaska, whose mission is to increase resident hire in construction. The organization was built to connect all trade unions and their jointly administered apprenticeship and training programs that you've heard about today into one system that would offer programs that reached out across Alaska to attract, train, and employ residents in construction, regardless of union affiliation or union membership. And of course, you know, after the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, there were many folks who said, gee, if we could only have that union training without the unions, you know, sort of thing. And well, the union said, hey, you know, we need to reach out. We need a strong resident workforce in Alaska if we're going to have a strong economy, if we're going to meet the challenges of the future. So as far as 10 years ago, they were looking at that. Alaska Works has developed successful programs that have been proven effective in moving resident Alaskans into construction jobs. They're uniquely designed to meet the needs of residents, employers, workers, and future workers. In the past 5 years, we've helped more than 1,000 residents become employed in construction. More than 85% of the residents AWP has served are employed in construction as a result of training. Now, that's our overall performance over time. And we have an evaluation of our programs that shows that, and it's based on Department of Labor information. The majority of persons served are retained in industry employment year after year, and that's just as critical. You can train for job training, but if people don't show up the following years and years after, and we're seeing about a 68 to 70% retention, which we think is really good, particularly when we serve communities like Kasigluk, you know, in St. Paul and in Savunga and places where training hasn't been offered in the past. We have developed successful programs. You may have heard of some of those. One is the Rural Apprenticeship Outreach Program. The legislature used to fund this program before oil crashed and we ran into our fiscal problems. And the Denali Commission brought it back in 2000 and awarded us a contract to reach out to rural Alaskans. It's been very successful. Women in the trades, we have the only operating women in the trades program in the state. Right now, women make up about 5% of the construction workforce. It's difficult for women to be part of it, but they're part of the future workforce, and our program is effective. We have a building maintenance repair apprenticeship program that is the largest registered apprenticeship program in rural Alaska. 125 registered apprentices today. These apprentices build affordable housing and modernize homes out in the smallest villages of Alaska. We're very proud of that program. And another program is our Helmets to Hard Hats program. You may have heard of our efforts to assist veterans and Alaska National Guardsmen and Alaska Military Reserves getting into the construction trades programs. And of course, you probably have heard of our pipeline training. I did present a packet, I think, to committee members, and inside was a DVD of the pipeline training that just occurred in Fairbanks. We've helped the trade unions train 170 people in the last 2 years, and about 95% of those folks, young Alaskans, apprentices, and many who aren't members of unions, have gone to work on the North Slope as a result of that training. I want to talk a little bit about the jointly administered apprenticeship programs who make our system work. The reason we can be effective is they have 21 trade apprenticeship programs. They have 1,600 apprentices that are registered with the federal government today, which is about 80% of the trade apprentices in the state of Alaska. They have doubled that in the last 5 years. In 2000, they had about 900, so 1,600, almost double. So they've been very aggressive. We just recently did a capacity survey of the jointly administered programs. 2005, workers and employers contributed over $9 million to industry training through their trust funds. What makes this so powerful is they've said, you can use our system, you can use our trainers, you can use our instruction equipment, you can go out and train folks who are not our members, you can attract them to the industry and let them make a choice. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the program numbers, because people say, well, how can you have a union-driven system that trains non-union workers? And that's exactly what we do. Now, we're not saying that they don't end up eventually, some of them, into the union, but it's primarily their choice. As I mentioned, we have 125 building maintenance repair apprentices building affordable housing in rural Alaska. We train over 100 persons for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium on force account projects building clinics and village safe water projects in rural Alaska. We will help 120 high school youth through our construction academies. You may have heard about our construction academies. One will be with the Anchorage School District, one's at the mouth of the Yukon, one's with Ute Ilivarnet out in the Bethel area, one is with Cook Inlet down in Ninilchik this year, and we're going to go to Klawak down there as well. And what we're doing is we're allowing high school students who have not had the opportunity to have vocational education in high school due to changes, due to budget constraints, an opportunity to have intensive hands-on training and a pathway into construction trades jobs. We anticipate helping 70 veterans get into employment this year and 70 rural apprentices. Senator Seekins, you asked the question about demographics. I can tell you that primarily the age group is about 22 to 24 that's really kind of ready, interested in construction, although we're finding younger workers who are interested because of the opportunities that are coming up, the high wages, and because they never knew about these opportunities. These opportunities are not spoken about in the high schools. And so now there is this opportunity. I also want to mention that when we talk about incentives, there's already some built-in market solutions in apprenticeship. It's not been mentioned, but an apprentice is hired at about 50% of the going rate. The employer does not have to pay the full rate for an unskilled worker. They pay half the rate. And as they advance, they get paid more. So that's a market solution that's in place. But there are job training programs that will subsidize the workers' wages if they are in a registered apprenticeship program. Also, the issue of employers hiring apprentices. In our system, we connect our folks up to 780 employers who do contribute to these programs and who hire apprentices. That's a lot of employers in the state of Alaska who will hire apprentices, and they're not asking for any incentives, but they are available. Let me see. I mean, this is what I do. I live for this stuff, so I get kind of carried away here. So anyway,
I don't have a number of people to testify yet.
I understand, right. And so I guess I will stop there. I'll be ready to answer questions and come to you again if need be.
And I see no questions, so thank you again.
Thank you,
Mr. Bitney.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is John Bitney, and I'm here today. I'm the lobbyist for the Alaska State Home Builders Association. Our legislative committee met just prior to this committee meeting and asked me to convey support for this bill. Because of lack of time, we will be preparing, though, a written statement, and henceforth, if this bill moves through the process, I'll have guys with tool belts here to offer this. Would just like to say that the bill is going in the right direction. There is a need for these type of workers in the residential construction industry today. We see that the need for pipeline workers is something that perhaps is years down the road, but there's certainly a need to get started on that today. And I'd just like to point out the commissioner referenced some efforts afoot now in Anchorage with the Anchorage Home Builders and others to try to get a program going through the King Career Center or something like that. And this gets at some of the discussion about employers placement. When our organization was asked if we would be interested in participating in that, the executive director for our organization called around to builder members over the course of just a short afternoon and phone calls and was able to come up with commitments to place 90 people, young people, on job sites. And this, I'm just trying to emphasize, this was a very short time period that she came up with those kinds of numbers. I don't think there was any anticipation of a wage subsidy. I mean, there's just that type of a need for people right now. I can go on and kind of give you some of the anecdotes, but I think we'll just kind of stop there. And we just mainly wanted to thank Senator Terrio and think this bill is headed in the right direction.
Thank you very much. Mike Gallagher, please. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Mike Gallagher, and I'm a business manager, secretary, treasurer of Labor's Local 341. Also, I'm a trustee for the Alaska Labor's Training and Apprenticeship Program. And so what I'd like to, I support SB 309, but I'd like to give you a rundown of what we did in 2005 and let you know what we planned for 2006. In 2005, we trained over 2,000 construction workers, new apprentices, and upgrading journeyman skills. We spent $1.25 million on training, and this year we expect to increase our funding by 25%, and that's money directly from contributions from our employers and employee contributions. We train in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Valdez, Southeast Alaska, Kodiak, Kenai, and Valdez. So we're training all over the state, and we'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebecca?
If I can just share this. Gosh, no pressure here as the only person sitting down to voice opposition.
My name is Rebecca Logan. I'm the president of Associated Builders and Contractors of Alaska, and I do greatly appreciate the opportunity that I've had with Senator Theriault today and before this committee. I am here today to ask you to oppose SB 309 as it is now written. Let me be very clear that it is our position that the intent of this bill is very good. We are very pleased to see the thought of creating a construction trades training grant program. Our problem with the bill is the proposed method for distributing the grant funds, and we see that as very bad for two reasons. First and foremost, this bill puts money into the hands of trainers. Now, at first glance, that appears to be the reasonable place to deposit training funds. But step back and look at the problem that we're trying to solve by creating this fund, a huge skilled labor shortage in the construction industry. The solution to the problem is training more people. The method for training construction workers is apprenticeship. Apprenticeship is a relationship between three entities, the apprentice, the employer, and the trainer. In that relationship, it is the employer and only the employer who has the ability to increase the numbers of people being trained. If employers don't agree to hire apprentices, new workers will not be trained. And yet every plan put forth to address this issue ignores the employers, or worse. At the beginning of this year, Governor Murkowski signed an administrative order that attempted to require employers to hire apprentices on state jobs. On the recommendation of the state attorney general, the language was toned down to suggest that they hire apprentices. Why not give employers an incentive to hire apprentices? Employers lose money when they commit to hiring an apprentice. They take on a new person with little or no skill and begin to train them. The production from the apprentice is low, and in addition, a journeyman is used to instruct the apprentice, which can result in less production from an experienced worker as they take on the role of trainer. As the apprentice progresses, this changes, but the initial investment is a loss for the employer. If we truly want to address the skilled labor shortage in Alaska by increasing the number of apprentices, we must encourage more employers to hire apprentices. This grant could be used as a financial incentive that would lead more employers to become involved in apprentice training. I appreciate what Mike Andrews said about the incentive already existing, in that when you hire an apprentice, they are paid a lower wage. That has not done it. Employers still are not willing to take on an apprentice. And I would guess that the unions would agree with that, as they are the ones who requested from the governor the administrative order to try to force people to take apprentices on. The lower wage is not enough to incentivize employers to take on an apprentice. The second problem I see with the proposed distribution method is the allocation of funds through the Alaska Department of Labor to Alaska Works Partnership. Alaska Works Partnership is the nonprofit agency that represents the building construction trade unions and their federally registered apprenticeship programs. As you can see, according to the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics in 2005, only 30% of Alaska's construction workforce was represented by organized labor. Are we really going to take money from Alaska's workers, most of whom do not belong to a union, and give those funds to a nonprofit that only supports union training programs? Now, Mike also mentioned that most of the training that they do is of non-union workers, and I would totally agree with that. That is the only training he'd be able to do because he doesn't run an apprenticeship program. That's pre-apprenticeship training, and those people are steered towards the unions. Last year, we at our apprenticeship program received 800 applications, and not one of them came from a pre-apprenticeship program that Alaska Works ran. As recently as 10 days ago, the Alaska Works website listed communities in Alaska and the numbers of workers available in those communities. The same page indicated that only employers signatory to a union could access those workers. That page no longer appears on the website, but I'm quite sure that that philosophy has not disappeared. Limiting training funds to such a group greatly limits the number of people who can be trained for jobs in the industry, and again, trained for apprenticeship jobs in the industry, and it's not the best use of training funds. It is also discriminatory legislation and not responsible legislation. I strongly suggest that you amend SB 309 to put training resources in the hands of those who can actually increase the number of people who are being trained through apprentice programs, the employers. I would also suggest that you amend SB 309 to ensure that any funds taken for this grant are distributed equally between the union and non-union workforce. Thank you, and if you have any questions.
See you at the moment. Thank you. I think that takes care of the testimony here in the room. I'd like to go to the Fairbanks LIO now. Click Bishop.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bundy.
Hi, Click. Tell your dad I still think Tanana Alice was the best dog on Fairbanks.
I'll do that. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
My name is Click Bishop, resident address 3365 Sandvik, Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm the apprenticeship coordinator for the Alaska Operating Engineers Training Trust. And I'm here to speak in favor of SB 309. A year and a half ago, I was at a meeting put together by the governor, and there was about 25 representatives from around the state there. How we're going to meet the needs of the construction workforce, both in oil and gas and civil, heavy, and highway. BP rolled out the manpower needs for the pipeline. They came to the bullet slide for pipe layer operators. We call them side booms in the industry here. And they had a slide there that said 600 operators, side boom operators. And they said, Click, how are you going to train them? I said, I'm not. And I said, we're going to train them. I said, it's too big a bite for any one entity to take on by themselves. And so I said, industry, labor, and government has to come together to make this work. There's nobody's got the resources to do it alone by themselves. So with that being said, I was invited a week ago to Caterpillar's Proving Grounds in Tucson at Tenaha Hills at the request of Caterpillar Tractor Company, and to preview and get a chance to operate the next generation of pipe layers that are going to be used on this Trans-Alaska gas line when it does come forward. Very impressive machine. With that being said, there was over 100 contractor representatives from the lower 48 and around the globe. The main consensus of the group was there's not enough skilled people and not enough equipment. At the end of the demonstration, the Caterpillar representative asked me, I had been working with Cat for over a year trying to lobby and work with them to showcase some of these new pipe layers here in Alaska, and I had sent them some training film. You know, we started doing this in 97, this pipeline training, and I sent some of our previous work down to them. And he asked me at the end of the day if I could help them, if we could help them with pipeline training. And I said, we'd be glad to help you if we could. And so not only do we have a need here in Alaska, but there's also a global need. And it's the prudent thing to do for us to step forward here with 309, all of us here at the table, to move forward to meet the needs in the upcoming years for the shortage of skilled workers. And I just like to comment that there's been a lot of testimony here today, but I think it was your question, Chairman Bundy, about high school students interested in the trade. Well, I have 500 people pick up applications average every year. Now that they don't all come back completed, I had a total of about 260 come back completed. But you know, I'm enjoy an occupation that everybody likes to run big yellow iron. So I'm a little bit ahead of the curve there in that respect. But we got the people here. We just need to train them and do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Click. For the information of the folks in the room here, we still have a number of people testify on 309. So it doesn't appear we will get to Senate Bill 241 today. That will be held over until Thursday for those that are here waiting for 241. We'll move on then to Charles Juergens.
Yes, thank you. My name is Charles Juergens. I live 2333 Holland Aviation Drive in North Pole, and I'm a district representative for Operating Engineers, District 7 in Fairbanks, and I'm a trustee, sit on the Operating Engineers Employers Training Trust. And I want to thank Senator Terrio for bringing SB 309 forward. This is what we need to train these young Alaskans for these future jobs. After all, this is about training young Alaskans for a mega project when it does arrive, and careers in the construction industry. And you know, we've, anyway, we've already, you know, these young people need opportunity, and what better way than have available apprenticeship and training for these jobs in the construction industry. And anyway, I support this 309. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Moving to Anchorage, we have Bob Morjo?
Morjo.
Thank you. Well, Morjo.
Yeah, it's a little French there.
Yeah.
Thanks to the committee for allowing me to testify today. I'm here to testify, of course, in support of Senate Bill 309. And I do want to applaud Senator Terrio on his forward thinking. This is something that is needed for all facets of the trades. I'd like to also thank Commissioner O'Clery for his commitment towards this 90% Alaska hire. That's something that really helps the young people of this state. And also, as Rebecca Logan mentioned earlier, would like to thank Governor Murkowski for signing the administrative order, I believe it was 226 last summer, requiring that 15% of heavy equipment hours on jobs 2.5 million or more be required to be performed by registered apprentices or trainees. Just want to bring out a few statistics here. We presently have approximately 150 apprentices in our program here in the state of Alaska, and between Alaska and Washington, right at 300 right now. We have 30 to 40 new trainees presently being trained out at the school in Palmer, our apprenticeship school in Palmer. And as Brother Click Bishop mentioned, you know, we do have an abundant amount of applicants every year, and unfortunately we have to turn many of those away because we don't have the positions to fill every year. And this is one of the things that the Governor Murkowski's administrative order is hopefully going to fulfill here. We need places to put these people. Training them is half of the problem. Putting them on the job so they're not sitting at home after we do it, train them, is the other half of it. So I applaud Senator Terrio for what he's trying to do, and I thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
You're welcome. Senator Terrio has a question.
Thank you. You're mentioning the administrative order 226 in your last comment that you have to turn some people away because you do not have positions to put them in. I guess you mean for the apprenticeship part of their training. Is that correct?
We only train what we think we can put to work. And so if we know that we have numerous more positions throughout the course of the summer, instead of a class of 30 or 40, we would like to train 80 to 100 or somewhere, you know, pick the number. But that's a job that Click has a hard time with every year, is trying to predict how many young people to train, because it's very costly to train. If we knew that we had, you know, 50 or 100 spots through the course of the summer, we would train those young people to fill those spots. But presently, we train to fulfill the spots that he can foresee, and that's anybody's guess at times. So that's what's meant by that, Secretary.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Vince? Hello, Vince.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of SB 309. As one of your constituents in District P, I appreciate the opportunity to express my support of this important bill. My name is Vince Beltrami. I'm the statewide training director of one of the largest and most successful training programs in the state. Our program is a joint labor management trust. The commissioner mentioned it earlier. We're the Alaska Joint Electrical Apprenticeship and Training Trust. We have a stellar record turning out the finest electrical workers in the state since the mid-1950s and enjoy a better than a 90% completion record. And not coincidentally, we are a 100% Alaska hire operation. We have over 400 apprentices registered in various classifications of the electrical industry, from electricians to power linemen to telecommunications workers to power plant operators. In addition, we trained over 800 in journey-level upgrade classes last year. More than 100 employers statewide contributed nearly $2 million last year to our program. Our apprentices, and the commissioner mentioned previous years, the amount that we matched. Last year, our STEP grant total for CDL training, roughly, and some STEP other assistance was about $200,000 on, and our employers put in roughly $2 million of their own money. Our apprentices receive 8,000 hours of on-the-job training, a minimum of 280 hours per year of instructor-led curriculum. And we've got the finest instructors. They're journey-level workers. They regularly attend annual training at the University of Tennessee, and many have several years of management experience in our trade. We've got two state-of-the-art training facilities, one in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks. We invested $2.3 million to construct a new training facility in Anchorage in 2000, and are expanding our Fairbanks facility right now. We're doubling that facility to the tune of about $1.1 million starting construction this summer. And that's all without any public funding assistance. We've proven a demonstrated record of being the best trainers for the electrical industry in the state of Alaska. Senate Bill 309 would ensure that we're able to better serve the needs of the state by expanding our ability to train even more workers, to be prepared to deal with the increased construction activity in the state, as well as to further augment an aging construction workforce. And contrary to what Ms. Logan's assertions were, if there were any amendments to this bill, I'd say distribution of funds not be based on union or non-union status, but basically on measured performance and the investment that's been made in the industry, because our employers have definitely put their money where their mouth is and contributed significantly over the years. I urge you to support Senate Bill 309 to ensure that monies are directed to the programs that have proven through the years to be the best trainers of construction workers in Alaska. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have at this time.
Thank you very much. Good to hear from home, and I don't see any questions, so thank you for turning out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In Dillingham, Dave McClure.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I serve as Executive Director of the Bristol Bay Housing Authority, also as Chairman of the Board for the Southwest Alaska Vocational Education Center, which is located on the King Salmon Air Force Base. I fully support Senate Bill 309. Our region's partnership with Alaska Works is strong. Training provided has benefited over 100 individuals in our region over the past several years. The apprenticeship program enables moving residents from the economically troubled fishery to new employment opportunities statewide. With the proposed oil and gas, possible pebble mine in our region, these training opportunities are paramount for stabilization of the local economy and for personal achievement of the individuals trained. On the union non-union issue, Bristol Bay Housing is a non-union employer. We use a number of non-union contracts and subcontractors. And Senate Bill 309, utilizing Alaska Works, is a good benefit for all Alaskan employers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else like to testify on 309? We have gotten through the list. Senator Terrio, just to add a thought to, for you to consider, I remember the old student loan program where the money went directly to the education provider, and then the students, in some cases, excuse me, were rather divorced of the process, and whether they showed up or not wasn't important, because the trainer just collected the money, and the trainer, I'm not saying that was in this case, but in that case, had little concern about the future employability of the trainee. And I'm wondering if you'd give some thought to something like a voucher program where the money went with the student, and there would then be some incentive to keep the student in the program for the funding to continue to flow. Just an idea that occurred to me, if you'd give it some consideration.
Okay.
If there's nothing more on 309, we'll set it aside. It's my intention to bring it back up on Thursday. Additionally, on Thursday, we have a bill we did not get to today, Senate Bill 241, and we have a bill that we have previously heard, 272, and I would like to be able to address those three bills on Thursday. Is there anything more to come before the committee? Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I think I will ask the Commissioner of the Department of Labor. We've talked about the different construction trades and crafts here, and I can think of numerous ones that have specific apprenticeship programs, but I'd like a complete list of which of the trades actually have requirements for a person before they get licensed or have the proper paperwork. They have to have a certain number of hours. I think that would be beneficial to have. Plus, I'm still trying to come to grips with, we hear from the AGC and the Alaska Home Builders that they are desperate for people to come in and perform the jobs that they have. But yet, we also hear from some of the trainers that there's a limitation on places to put trainees. So there does appear to be somewhat of a bottleneck somewhere in the system as far as, getting the trainees that we have through the process and in to fill those jobs. So I've got some questions that, I'll be talking to the individuals that testified today and try and track that down and figure out what the ultimate solution is.
Look forward to further information on 309.
Good.
I'm sorry. And that's right, 307 will be back before us on Thursday as well, if you have your questions answered.
Right.
So, anything else come before the committee? If not, thanks to the committee for their attention, and thanks all who testified. We will stand adjourned at 3:43.